The category trading income encompasses both income from a trade, such as a plumber or a builder, and income from a profession or vocation. A profession would include people like accountants or lawyers, and a vocation includes people like actors, ballet dancers, or theatrical performers, etc. First of all, let us look at a definition of trading. Income tax is charged on the annual profits or gains arising or accruing to any person residing in the United Kingdom from any trade, profession or vocation. So what is a trade? A trade is defined as every manufacture, adventure or concern in the nature of trade. A trade is defined in the legislation as a trade, which is a circular definition, so does not take us a great deal further. Therefore, the interpretation of these provisions has been left largely to the courts. The courts have developed a number of tests to determine whether somebody is trading, and these are known as the badges of trade. We will now take a detailed look at the badges of trade. First of all, we will need to identify whether there is a profit-seeking motive. It is not the existence of a profit which is important. It is the motive to earn one. However, the revenue will only really be interested in this issue if a profit has actually been earned, because they have got something to tax. What about losses? A taxpayer may argue that they are trading in order to utilize a loss to reduce their tax bill. The taxpayer must demonstrate the motive, not the existence of profit. Another badge of trade is the frequency and number of similar transactions. If we do something once, never to be repeated again, it is less likely that we will be counted as trading. However, if we keep doing it, it is more likely that we are trading. For instance, if I sold you my car, which I had owned for 4 years, and I bought myself another car, and sold that one, say, 2 years later, it is unlikely the revenue would consider that I am trading in cars. If, however, I sold a car every month, it is more likely that they will seek to tax the profits as trading income. The most notable case in this area is Pickford versus Quirk, where a taxpayer purchased a mill with the object of using it for trading purposes. However, it turned out that the mill was in a much worse state than they had imagined, and the best thing they could do was to strip all the items out of it and sell it piecemeal. They realized that once they had done this, they had made a considerable profit, so they did it again, and again, and again. As a result of the repeated number of transactions, it was held that the profits were taxable as trading income. Modification of the asset in order to make it more sellable. If we buy something, do nothing to it, and then sell it, it is less likely that we are trading. However, let us say I bought a car, put a new engine in it, resprayed the body, and made it generally a more attractive car to buy. It is more likely that I would be considered as trading than if I had done nothing to it. Nature of the asset. In this particular badge of trade, we could pin the trading label onto a single one-off transaction, simply because we cannot justify the particular asset as purchased for any other purpose than to resell it. The most notable case in this area is Routledge versus the Commissioners of the Inland Revenue. In this particular case, a taxpayer purchased 1 million rolls of toilet paper in one single transaction, and sold them on at a profit in another single transaction. They were held to be trading, as there was no other justifiable reason to purchase such a large quantity of toilet paper, and they could not argue that this was simply overstocking. Another issue that we need to look closely at is the connection with an existing trade. Taking an example of a car, let us say that as a tax advisor, I sell a car. It's unlikely that I would be trading in cars because there is no link between selling cars and being an accountant. If, however, I was a car mechanic who occasionally sold a car, the revenue are much more likely to successfully tax the profits on the sale of cars, along with my existing trade, as there is a direct link between repairing cars and selling cars. Other badges of trade would also need to apply, but it is something that the revenue look very closely at. Financing arrangements can also determine whether somebody is trading. If an asset is purchased on a very short-term loan, which the taxpayer is unable to fund without selling the asset again, then the revenue can successfully argue that the asset was purchased specifically with a view to selling it. This was given in the case of Wisdom versus Chamberlain, where the comedian Norman Wisdom bought a mound of silver bullion on a short-term loan. He could not service the interest payments from his existing money, But as soon as he sold the bullion and repaid the loan, he found he had made a substantial profit. This profit was taxed as trading income. The length of ownership of the particular item. If you have owned something for a long time, it is much easier to justify why you bought it. For example, for your own private consumption. If, however, you have only owned it for a short period, it is much more likely that the revenue would successfully argue that it was purchased with the aim of selling it at a profit. Sales organizations is another badge of trade. A case which nicely highlights this is the case of the Cape Brandy Syndicate. In this particular case, a syndicate of chartered accountants distilled brandy. They distilled far more than they could actually drink themselves and sold the surplus. The revenue sought to tax them as trading. They argued that all they were doing was simply selling what they could not physically drink themselves, because accountants are not heavy drinkers. However, as they had set up a special phone line and information desk and published brochures and adverts advertising their brandy, the revenue successfully argued that they had commenced a trade. Finally, how was the asset acquired? By gift or inheritance? In other words, what is the reason for the sale of the asset? Let me give an example. Let us say our taxpayer here, Maud, inherits from her late mother a wardrobe full of fur coats, which she does not want to wear, so she puts an advert in the local paper to sell them. The revenue spot this advert and seek to tax Maud for any profits earned. As Maud inherited the coats, it is highly unlikely that the trading label can stick to these transactions. However, if Maud had gone out and purchased a wardrobe full of fur coats and then sold them at a profit, it is much more likely that she would be held to be trading. Simply realizing your inheritance for cash rather than fur coats is not the commencement of a trade. What is important with these badges of trade is that in some circumstances, one single badge is enough to show trading, like in the case of Routledge versus CIR. But in other cases, we need to look at a combination of the badges of trade. But the trigger which is going to get the revenue most interested in it is the existence of a profit in the first place. Let us now take a look at a particular type of transaction which the revenue often look closely at due simply to the size of the profits involved. Here we are looking at land transactions, the purchase and sale of land and buildings. It is in this area that the most cases involving the badges of trade have been taken to the courts. Let us look at some of the important principles. First of all, we need to ask the question, is our taxpayer investing or dealing? If we are dealing, we are trading. It is this question which is posed in the case of Marson versus Morton. Here we had a taxpayer who purchased some land with the intention of holding on to it as an investment for a period of at least 2 years. In order to increase the value of the land, they did apply for planning permission which, looking at the badges of trade, is a modification to an asset to make it more sellable. It was held in this case because the original intention was the purchase of an investment. No trade was being carried on. It is not what the taxpayer says which determines intentions, of course. It is what the surrounding evidence supports. So documented intentions can make the difference. Another question that we must ask is our taxpayer a resident in the property or a developer who is refurbishing a property for onward sale? This was addressed in the case of Kirkby and Hughes. Here we had a builder who carried out the following transactions. He purchased a run-down house. He then carried out a lot of repair and refurbishment work and sold it at a healthy profit. He then purchased a strip of land and built a house on it, again selling it at a substantial profit. He then moved on and purchased a barn, converted it into a house. The question is he trading? The courts believed that he was, because they could apply enough of the badges of trade to him. There clearly was a profit-seeking motive. He modified the assets which he purchased. He had a connection with an existing trade. And the length of ownership in each case was fairly short. So, the profits on the first house were taxable as trading income, along with all of the other properties which he had bought and sold. Looking specifically at one of the badges of trade, we should also identify a reason for the purchase and a reason for the sale. This is demonstrated in the case of Taylor versus Good. Here we had a husband and wife, and the husband went out and purchased a property, which his wife refused to live in, saying, "I do not want to live in that property." As a result, he had no option but to sell it. However, because it was a one-off transaction, the revenue felt that the batches of trade applied because the asset was only owned for a very short period of time. However, there was clearly another reason for the sale. There was an intention by the taxpayer to live in it, not to sell it, and as a result, the transaction was held not to be a trading transaction. Let us now take a look at the frequency of transaction. This can be demonstrated by an example. Here we have Michael, who buys unprofitable restaurants, turns the business around, and sells them at a profit. He has done this 12 times. The idea came to him when he sold his first restaurant, which he had run as the owner and manager for a period of 10 years. The question we are asking is he chargeable to tax as trading in respect of 1. The restaurant in general, which he had run for a short period, and 2. The first restaurant, which he had run for a long period. To answer question 1, we must look closely at the badges of trade. Clearly, by what he is doing, there is a profit-seeking motive, which is readily identifiable. The frequency of transactions which he is undertaking points towards a trade. Modifications to the asset purchased, taking an unprofitable restaurant and turning it around, the length of ownership, he owns them for a relatively short period of time, the reason for the sale, to make money. The conclusion that we can draw, therefore, is that these transactions will clearly be trading transactions. The question is, do the future transactions taint the first one? Unfortunately, it would appear that the answer to this question is yes. This is given in the case of Leach versus Pogson. In this particular situation, an individual owned a driving school for some period of time and sold it at a profit. He then purchased, turned around, and sold driving schools in the future, and it was held that not only did the future driving schools get charged a tax as a trade, but the original disposal, although originally treated as a capital transaction, would be turned into a trading transaction. This, in practice, is something we need to be very wary of. Let us now take a look specifically at share dealing. Here we have Muriel, and she thinks she has got an infallible system to predict share price movements, and over a 2-year period, she actually entered into over 100 transactions buying and selling shares. She made a profit on some, but overall she made a loss, so her system was not as infallible as she thought. Will she manage to obtain loss relief against her general income? In order to set a loss against your other income, the loss must be a trading loss. We will come on to this later in the module. So the question is Muriel dealing or investing? This was examined in the case of Salt versus Chamberlain, where it was held that all share transactions, unless they are undertaken by a properly registered share dealer. So therefore, if a private individual who is not a share dealer buys shares in a company and does this many, many times, he can never have the badges of trade pinned onto those transactions. Such profits will be taxable as capital gains and subject to CGT, with all the advantages of indexation where relevant and, of course, taper relief. I would like to take a look now at some anti-avoidance provisions. These apply specifically to the largest type of trading transaction, those involving land. When dealing with a land transaction, the first thing that we need to look at, of course, is applying the badges of trade. If the badges of trade applies to the transaction, it will be treated as trading. If the badges of trade do not apply, then the transaction will be treated as a capital transaction, and in most cases, be charged to tax under the capital gains rules, and CGT will be payable. However, the transaction could be taxed as a sundry income. This will be the case if the miscellaneous income rules can be applied to the transaction. This will only apply when a taxpayer has deliberately taken steps to turn a trading transaction into a capital one. Let me give you an example. If our taxpayer thinks he can make a killing by buying and selling property at a profit, this is likely to be taxed as trade profits. If, however, he has this brilliant idea of setting up a limited company, putting the property in that and then selling the shares, under the case of Salt versus Chamberlain, the sale of the shares cannot be treated as a trading transaction, but the revenue will tax it as miscellaneous income. This means that the profits will become taxable as income. Finally, let us take a look at taxable and non-taxable receipts. Only incomings on revenue account are taxable as trading income. If amounts are wholly unexpected and unsolicited, then they are not taxable. This is highlighted in the case of Simpson versus John Reynolds and Company, where a taxpayer received a voluntary payment from an ex-customer when they were asked to cease to act as their insurance broker. Because the payment was not invoiced, not expected as purely a gift, it was not held to be part of the taxable trading income. In the case of Murray versus Goodhues, an ex gratia payment given to a pub landlord as a result of the cancellation of his pub tenancy was held not to be taxable. The reason for this was because the receipt of the compensation had nothing to do with him buying and selling alcoholic drinks and running a pub. It was as a result of the termination of the pub tenancy. However, if amounts are expected, then they will be taxable. This is given particularly in the case of Creed versus H&M Levinson Limited, where a taxpayer was offered an ex gratia amount from an ex-customer and successfully sued for more. As the receipt was clearly solicited and expected, it was taxable. In the case of McGowan versus Brown and Cousins, an estate agent, who received compensation for not being appointed as letting agent, also was taxed on the income as it related specifically to the trade, and it was solicited and expected. That concludes this session on trading income and the badges of trade.